Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about OpenVPN, the number one virtual private network software in the world. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 509, recorded December 5th, 2018. OpenVPN. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. And by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of it. But today's going to be one of those. Well, you probably are aware that you're using it. And projects you may want to download right after the show and play with. And this is also probably going to be one of those for those of you that don't know about this kind of stuff. Joining me once again, so recently also on this show as a co-host, but back again the next following week, Jonathan Bennett. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Randall. It's good to be here. It's kind of the curse of being self-employed. I always answer that email with, yes, I suppose I can be available if you need me.
And I totally appreciate that because sometimes it's amazing. I have like five or six people that I email to say, are you available for the show? And when I get a bunch of no's all at the same time, it's a little tough. And I can understand during the holidays it's really difficult because people are, being with family, things like that. But I have the curse on the other side where because I am self-employed, I have a flexible schedule, so that's why I'm able to put this show on as often as I can. Occasionally, like when I'm on a cruise ship and there's no bandwidth, I have to call in a couple of you guys on a given show. That's even harder because it's like, wow, I got to have two overlapping schedules now. Well, this show isn't about us. This show is about the project of open source, about the people that are making it, and about the cool stuff that they've all made this week. No exception to that. OpenVPN. OpenVPN is exactly what it sounds like. It's a way of creating a virtual private network, which is a way of tunneling encrypted traffic across the real networks. And OpenVPN is actually old. It's been around since May of 2001. And that's why I can't believe that in 11 years we haven't had OpenVPN on this show. So I'm really happy that we have today's guest, Francis Dina, who's going to be coming on in a few minutes to talk about OpenVPN. What do you want to talk about, Jonathan? Okay, OpenVPN. What do you want to say about OpenVPN? I want to talk about the weather.
Oh, so OpenVPN, I have used this project for years and years. I was trying to think what my first use of it was. And it was either trying to put a VoIP telephone system together off of my little tiny laptop in a Starbucks, or it was trying to get a buddy of mine unfettered internet access when he was going to a college that had a really brain-dead internet filter. But it was one of those two things. But I fell in love with the idea of OpenVPN. You know, I've described it to people as being able to virtually string a really, really, really long Ethernet cable through the internet. And I just it's so cool. Networking stuff, the plumbing like this of the internet, I like it. I enjoy it.
Well, and I install OpenVPN servers on my cloud machine and Inside Cruise's cloud machine. My work ZipRecruiter primary client uses it. On the Mac, I use TunnelBlick, which actually launches the real OpenVPN under the hood, but that's a GUI for it. Even on my iPhone, I have the OpenVPN client here. Oops, I don't know if I can get it without the glare. Probably not. Well, whatever. So I have it everywhere, and it's such a common thing to have. But we use OpenVPN at ZipRecruiter so that I can tunnel into the inside of their network and access machines that don't have any outside access at all. So we send some of the traffic that way, and we send all the DNS that way, which I'm kind of occasionally disturbed by, but that's the way it works. So anything else you want to say before we get started?
No, I think any other comments I have would probably be best packaged as questions for our guests, so we can dive in.
Good plan. Good plan. All right. Well, before we bring Francis on, we do have an important business to do, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Let's talk about buying a home for a minute. Because of rising interest rates, there's a lot of unpredictability when it comes to buying a home these days. It's causing a lot of anxiety with folks. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans are doing something about that. They're calling it the power buying process. Here's how it works. Step one, answer a few simple questions and they'll check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Step two, Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval, which gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Step three, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you win. It's the thinking you would expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply, based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Francis Dino. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm actually right now in Pleasanton, at our office in Pleasanton, California.
Okay. So you're south of me. Let's see which way south. That way. Okay. Waving in your general direction. Okay. Anyway, enough of that. So give us a 30,000-foot view. When somebody, what problem does somebody have when they're reaching for OpenVPN as a solution?
Well, the problem that they would have mostly is businesses who actually got their data insulated in a private network or maybe in a private cloud, which is not visible to the public internet. And you want to create a tunnel from a particular either corporate network or even from any device, whether it's a mobile, whether it's a remote worker. And you want to give them access to those resources, whether it's basically whatever web services you've got, database. But all these resources and the data are basically insulated. They're isolated and shielded in a particular private network private cloud that's not visible to the public internet. So you want to give them access through the VPN. So the VPN will go through different checks, saying, okay, now you're going to have to authenticate. We're going to do dual-factor authentication. Once we verify you've got the right certificate on your device, now we're going to let you in and tunnel all your traffic all the way to the private cloud. So think of it like what you were mentioning about stretching an Ethernet or stretching basically a virtual tunnel or virtual wire from all the way from your private cloud or private network to the device so they can have access to that network. That's so a typical use case.
Okay. And OpenVPN is asymmetrical in the sense that I've got clients on my laptop and on my phone, like I just showed, but somebody has to set up a server somewhere. Is it always asymmetrical like that, or is there ever like server to server communication?
Well, there is, it's always actually that has to be client to server. So the server, it's really serving the clients to provide access to particular services. And the reason why you have server, in top of just creating a particular tunnel and give you to the access, the server typically doesn't give you access to the entire network. So there are some other, actually, I would say, access control capabilities. So if I want to say, okay, I want to set up some policies here to say, okay, particular users or a group of users, sales department, engineering organization, have only access to particular services, to particular resources. I can basically control and govern that by the server itself. So that's why you have to have a server there. So it doesn't mean that you're going to have just peer-to-peer communications. It's symmetric, and you're going to have access to everything, because the idea of the server is the administrator or the IT person who's responsible for that private cloud or the network will have to basically manage that and manage those policies. What is exactly the policy that they have to have? So that's a really a typical use case. What you are saying about the peer-to-peer is really that's more side-to-side. But side-to-side is if you have two different clouds or if you have, say, a corporate network and you want to interconnect your corporate network with your private cloud, that's more of a peer-to-peer. So it's not really a remote access. So that's a different use case for the VPN as well. And you can set up an OpenVPN as such that you can have to peer-to-peer. But you always have to have a client and server in order to interconnect the two different sites.
And as I said in the opening of the show, the OpenVPN's been around since 2001. It's actually a fairly old project in terms of community open source.
Yes.
How long have you been involved with it?
Well, okay, so when James started 2002, he started the project itself. It was just a project. And then I met James in 2005. I was actually doing more of a commercial version of the VPN. So I started at the time, it wasn't called OpenVPN Inc., but I was looking for a solution. I had this view of how VPN is going to be built on the cloud, and the market is really was moving toward cloud. So I met James, and we joined our forces together, and we basically, he's the co-founder, and we both basically the founders of this company. And I took the open source and come up with a business model for it. So we've got all these open source, we've got the software, but we need to come up with some business model where we can make money and actually develop the open source even more and get the OpenVPN to the next level. And that's when I met James 2005. So the company itself, OpenVPN Inc., really started in 2005.
Hey, Francis, it's great to have you here today. And as we mentioned earlier, we do have a live show here in the chat room, and we already have a question from the chat room. ClearNet Only wants to know, is there a basic turnkey way to set up an OpenVPN server, like on a VPS, for example? And to tack on that, how difficult is it? What's the easiest way to get started with OpenVPN?
Well, I think the easiest way is actually to start on the Amazon Cloud, I would say. So there's a little bit of a turnkey. You could actually start an AMI, which itself, we have a product called Access Server. So you can launch that on Amazon Cloud. And it comes with the two concurrent connections for free. It doesn't cost you anything. So the easiest way, I would say, to launch it on Amazon Cloud right now, AWS. That's the easiest way. But if you want to deploy that as a VPS on a Linux system, you're going to have to go some few basically configuration. It depends which version of OpenVPN. If you're looking at just the community version, it's a little bit more work. If you're looking at the enterprise edition of OpenVPN, which is the Access Server, that can be launched much, much easier, both on whatever platform you've got. And we've got different support for different distribution systems, Linux distribution systems. And also we have the support for AWS, the support for Azure. You can launch it on Azure. You can launch it also on Google Cloud Platform.
So this would be a good place to talk about the difference between what you call the community version, which I assume is the open source project itself, and then the enterprise version. What's the difference? What's the upsell to ask someone to pay money for OpenVPN?
Well, the community version is kind of the tools. View it as a toolbox, right? You've got all these different bells and whistles at the core. So it's really the core software. And the enterprise version is really we build the management interface on top of it, meaning all the UI, all the management, all the authentication that you can authenticate with LDAP, RADIUS, and now we're releasing capability of clustering. So it's mostly suited for really, I would say, an IT person that they don't want to go through the basically trouble of basically building their own kind of management interface. If they have the resources, they do it. Like as an example, Google, to give you an example, when they started with our enterprise edition, and they deploy that in their network internally to use OpenVPN. But then after 3 years, they decided, well, they have the resources and they need more functionality and more features. And we are specifically focusing on small to mid-sized companies. So they decided to build their layer management and their layer of the UI. So they've built actually their entire basically solution around the open source. So if you've got the staff, if you've got the resources to really pour some investment into it, you can do it yourself. And if you are very knowledgeable in terms of Linux and how to build it, how to maintain it, then yeah, I mean that's the idea of the community version. But the enterprise version is really for mostly network administrator, the IT, the company, and alongside with that also remember, the enterprise edition comes with the support. So we do have basically a support system there. It's a ticketing system, and we have support staff that will help you and set up and basically help you with any kind of questions. So that's how the model works, basically. And it starts pretty sometimes. I mean, it's very inexpensive. It scales. So if you have only few connections, it's not going to cost you a lot of money for a lot of small businesses. You know, if they're going to be paying only a few hundred bucks a year, it's not a huge investment.
Excellent. So we've talked a little bit about the enterprise use case. What about the individual use case? Is there a reason that someone that's not associated with the big company, but just their laptop in a coffee shop might want to use something like OpenVPN?
Yes, definitely there is a use case for consumers, I would say. So the consumers would be, I mean, there are a lot of VPN providers out there that actually saying, well, you need a VPN for privacy and security. So if you are basically, but in this case, the server is hosted by the service provider itself. So the idea there is really you want to connect to a VPN server, say, in a particular country. So say if you are in China, and then China is blocking a particular website. So say they're blocking Facebook, they're blocking Twitter. So if you're traveling to China, it's very funny. A lot of even travel agency that they are actually selling you into coming to China, they tell you, oh, by the way, if you come to China, please make sure you have VPN in your machine because you're not going to be able to access. So that's one use case for consumers when they are traveling to really circumvent the firewall of a particular country or of the ISPs, that I can get access and I can connect to a server that's it's in US that's provided by a particular service provider to access content that I'm unable to access. So that's one use case. Another use case is really it's just a matter of trust. So if you're in a country and you don't really trust the ISP, maybe they are looking at your information, the ISP is monitoring what you're doing, which website you're visiting, and all that stuff, right? And you want to say, okay, I trust this VPN provider, so I'm going to connect to their VPN server in a country that I really trust. And then like US, for instance. So there is that use case. There are other use cases as well, like if you are in a public Wi-Fi, like in a Starbucks and things like that, and you don't want to have somebody next to you, like, you know, looking at your information or monitoring or having some level of man-in-the-middle attacks there. So VPN would be safer in that case because all your information is encrypted, again, over the Wi-Fi, so nobody can tell exactly which website you're visiting and all that. Another aspect of this is privacy. So privacy, certain aspects, when you're surfing the net, your public IP address is pretty much changed to whatever public IP address of that particular provider. So you get a different IP address, which is not your public IP address. And that's very important because sometimes when you're surfing the net and you are at home and you end up in a very malicious website, and that malicious website would basically be able to grab your public IP address and start attacking your network. So if you get a lot of DDoS attack on your network, guess what your ISP is going to do? Your ISP is going to take your network down for a while, for a couple of days, say, what is going on here? Why are you being DDoSed? So you can protect yourself against these malicious attacks. The other things is also a lot of VPN, not a lot, few VPN providers are adding kind of cloud security. So when you actually connect to a particular VPN provider, it's another level of security level that they can provide because the ISP, they're not in the security business. So now they have more of a threat management capabilities in there. So your traffic is going to go through that cloud, and that cloud will basically inspect all the traffic, not inspect in details, but at least will detect some level of malware. If you're visiting a site and you are unaware of it, like say you get an email and you get basically a link that you have to click on, and you click on it and accidentally you click on it, and that's basically a malware. It's taking you to a website that's pretty much malicious. In that case, the cloud will be able to block that for you. And so you could basically, you will have this capability of blocking all the malwares out there on the internet. So it's going to be much safer to surf, through the internet if you use a credible VPN provider that has these kind of capabilities. So this is maybe overwhelming. It's too many use cases.
No. It's great. I wanted to dig a little deeper into one of those you mentioned, and that is, in an oppressive regime like, perhaps China and the Great Firewall or some other places. Isn't it apparent if they're doing deep packet inspection that someone is running OpenVPN? I seem to remember an article from years ago about the Chinese firewall even having an automatic detection and blocking system. So they would do something like see traffic they thought was OpenVPN or Tor, turn right around and try to connect to the IP address that it was going to. And if they indeed found a server there, they would just add that IP address to its blacklist. Is that something that hits OpenVPN, and how do you deal with that?
Absolutely. It's not only OpenVPN, but actually China is, in a way, you're going kind of competing against the state right here. And mm-hmm. So it's a cat and mouse situation. They are doing everything possible, and that they have army of engineers there to really block VPN. So one way of doing this is they're detecting OpenVPN protocol, and they say, now we know what the destination IP is. They take that IP address and they put it in their list to block it. Okay, that's one way of doing it. But remember, a lot of VPN providers also are becoming smarter, right? So they're changing their IP addresses, on the fly. At the same time, on top of OpenVPN, I mean, we do run kind of also a VPN service for the consumer. It's called Private Tunnel. So we offer that for consumer. It's not our main business, but we have it. We have also something called obfuscation techniques. And obfuscation techniques, what they are is basically the traffic will not look like VPN. It will look like any kind of HTTP or SSL traffic. And so that's very, very hard to actually detect, and very hard even with deep packet inspections, because even deep packet inspections, you can't get to this level of encrypted traffic, you know. So it is a kind of a cat and mouse situations right now. I mean, we see that all the time, you know.
The obfuscated traffic, is that available in the free, the consumer edition? The open source part of it.
Yeah, it is available on Private Tunnel. Yes, we do have. And now we're going to be launching some more obfuscation techniques that we've been testing it from China. But that's not the market we're going after. I understand China. Maybe it's they are very frustrated about OpenVPN and the VPN services. I mean, they don't like it. It's not all, China is not alone. Iran is the same thing. And, one time we got a letter even from some Iranian thanking us for our service and being able to access the world and connect to the free world. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing. We get a lot of these emails and letters, people thanking us for this, you know. Turkey, they block also VPN. Saudi Arabia, and I have philosophy about this. I say any country that blocks VPN, you can envision, there is no freedom there, and it's pretty much an authoritarian government.
Yes. We do have another question.
So that's
from the
analogy
room.
I use.
Yes. Oh, makes sense. We have another question from the chat room along these same lines. Eric Duckman wants to know, does OpenVPN traffic look like normal SSL traffic?
Well, OpenVPN does not look like a normal SSL. We're using SSL basically in terms of the encryptions and all the authentications, but it does not look like SSL exactly because we run over UDP. So typically SSL runs over TCP. And the reason why we run over UDP is for the purpose of the performance and the speed. Because if you think about the internet, how internet is designed, one of the fundamental design of the internet, it's a datagram service. It's a connectionless. There is no connection. The TCP runs really at the endpoint, at the host. So TCP does not run over the internet itself unless you're connecting to a server, and then it becomes the TCP between the two endpoints. But the internet itself, the routers, only operates at the IP level, at basically datagram level. So what we've done with OpenVPN, we're saying, okay, if we're going to maintain the same level of performance as an internet, we have to run it over UDP. So it doesn't exactly, and also it's a different port. We use port 1194. Now, sometimes certain service provider or some network, even corporate network, they block UDP. So it will automatically switch to TCP, which TCP in that case will run over 443. So it's going to look like more of an SSL traffic in that case.
Okay, so that was my follow-up. If we then force OpenVPN into TCP mode and tell it to move to 443, at that point, how much does it look like just an HTTPS connection? And is there a way for someone to figure out what it is?
It doesn't look like HTTPS exactly in terms of the request and all that. There is another layer we'll add, and what we call TLS, obfuscation. So the obfuscation on top of OpenVPN, the 443, it will run over 443, but it looks exactly like an HTTP traffic. But OpenVPN does not exactly look, only the negotiation aspects and in terms of negotiating the sessions and things like that, that looks like SSL. But otherwise, it's easily detectable. So anybody can detect this is really OpenVPN protocol. You know, the handshaking aspects of it.
I can't let Jonathan have all the fun stuff. So I also wanted to break in here because I run my OpenVPN server on 443, and I have it set up so that it's usually UDP for performance, but I can quickly tweak it and make it TCP over to 443. So it's really really kind of handy. So I'm already doing that. I moved it off 1194 a long time ago. So that's the way that worked. And I do have a couple more questions to ask. But before we do that, I do have some business to do. Because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with droplets, virtual machines that are a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets and customize from there. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. The easy-to-use control panel and API lets developers spend more time coding and less time managing their infrastructure. Industry-leading price to performance. Access the computing resources you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you pay per month with a flat pricing structure across all data center regions. Included at no additional cost. 99.99% uptime SLA, cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise SSDs, and easy-to-use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, and including Stonehenge.com, my company, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That's do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Floss Weekly. And speaking of DigitalOcean, I Googled, if you Google DigitalOcean OpenVPN server, you come up with a one-click up-in-the-air solution. It's all taken care of by DigitalOcean. So thank you for that, DigitalOcean. They've been a real good benefit for the internet these days. So I wanted to ask a follow-up question, and now I'm so distracted. Jonathan, why don't you pick it up for a second?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. So we did have another question from the chat room. This was in the queue, and I didn't get to it. WireGuard. Are you familiar with WireGuard? And then, so what are your thoughts on WireGuard? And then, is there ever going to be a WireGuard mode built into OpenVPN?
Well, WireGuard is basically another attempt in terms of, so building basically another level of a VPN. But WireGuard initially, it was started more for peer-to-peer, and it's built, it's a way, way more simpler protocol at the lower level, I would say. And it's mostly site-to-site, but now I guess WireGuard has the ambitions to be built on Android and iOS and all kind of platforms. Now, the WireGuard, the idea there, the main concept is really the performance. It's not in terms of course, all these kind of different type of ciphers or encryption. We have planned to support all that. But at the same time, OpenVPN, right now, what you see in the community is OpenVPN 2. We are going to be releasing OpenVPN 3, which is going to be operating at the kernel level, at the Linux kernel. So it's going to have as good performance as WireGuard as well. So I don't know. We don't have any plans yet to kind of support WireGuard, but it is possible. It depends exactly how much overlapping is between OpenVPN 3 and our next generation OpenVPN, which basically runs at the wire speed as well, and the WireGuard. So.
Okay, so IPv6 introduced this thing called IPsec. Why don't I just use IPsec instead of something like OpenVPN?
Well, I mean, remember, I mean, IPsec is a different protocol, right? So than OpenVPN, and you could use IPsec and IPv6 definitely. I mean, that's a different protocol and different level of authentications, and so in a way, they're two different protocols. So if you look at the mostly used protocol, and it's OpenVPN is being used more than IPsec. So yeah, you could use IPsec. I'm not sure about the IPsec server. I mean, there is some open source projects like OpenSwan and things like that. It is on the kernel. I'm not sure about the speed, the performance, the number of features, the capability comparing to OpenVPN. But in a way, I mean, IPsec is just another protocol, you know?
Okay. And how, so OpenVPN that I would download from OpenVPN.net, the community edition, how many other implementations of OpenVPN are there? Are there any competing ones?
No, there are not really, not from an open source perspective. There are actually companies who are building a consumer product based on OpenVPN. There are a lot of VPN provider who is taking our open source and building on top of it a commercial version of VPN. They're not calling it OpenVPN, but they're saying they're supporting OpenVPN protocol. So I'm not aware of any kind of product that's actually building OpenVPN from scratch and using the same protocol. Although actually Microsoft is trying to do that on their Azure cloud, but I think we're working with them and convince them that the best way to do this is really to deploy our solution OpenVPN as an open source, you know.
Well, what license is OpenVPN under?
It's under GPL version 2.
So wouldn't that mean that people would have to give you any source changes they made?
They do. They have to. So any kind of changes, they have to bring it back. Well, it depends what kind of changes. If they are only adding capabilities at the level of the API, then they can just take the open source and bundle it and compile it, and then if they're using just an API interface, then they don't have to. I mean, most of these service providers, that's what they do. And I'm sure there are a lot of companies out there that they're violating the GPL, because we've seen GPL, OpenVPN, in apps and VPN, and they don't call it OpenVPN. But when we're looking at the traffic itself, it's actually OpenVPN protocol. And so, I don't want to mention the name of the companies who violated our GPL, and they've actually submitted that app to Apple iOS. We've been able to take down some of these apps, actually. We've sent sometimes either it's a violation of GPL, sometimes it's a violation of our trademark, you know, because we have a registered trademark OpenVPN. So we had a number of maybe individual just in China or whatever, all these countries just claiming OpenVPN, but it's not really OpenVPN. Yeah, they're taking our OpenVPN and building that an app is kind of half cooked and it's broken and all that stuff. So,
well, there's nothing stopping somebody from reading the OpenVPN protocol specifications and implementing it from scratch and not being related then to your GPL license, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually, there are companies are trying to do that, and just which is fine. They can do that. But the problem with that is not about the protocol. Is the issue here is about open source, because when you have your security software as an open source, then basically it's subject to reviews. I mean, a lot of researchers out there, they basically say, well, OpenVPN is the most secure protocol. Why? Because it's an open source. It's really, and that's the difference between OpenVPN and IPsec. Well, IPsec, you go to a company and say, well, we're supporting IPsec like Cisco, but then they're going to tell you, well, trust us. It's a black box. You know, you can't review the code. But trust us, this is the most secure protocol. Well, then you're going to have to trust them. Or do you trust an open source where it's really now being reviewed and being basically somehow, you know, reviewed by a lot of researchers and can tell you exactly how secure is this protocol?
So speaking of that, what's OpenVPN's track record like for security?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I mean, if you Google OpenVPN, we've had free issues, but immediately our community was very, very good at it and coming back with fixes like any other open source, like OpenSSL and things like that. So our track record has been very, very good, specifically related to one of the fundamental things we have in OpenVPN protocol is the signature on the packet itself, certificate-based. So when you have the right certificate, every packet will have the signature. If that signature is not valid, the packet will be dropped silently. So it's very hard for the hackers when you use OpenVPN to really get to your network. So it's very, very secure at that level, you know.
Cool.
So the most security vulnerability are at the higher level of protocol. So when you drop packets right there at the lower level, when every packet has that signature, you know, it's very hard for the hackers. The only thing the hackers can do probably just doing DDoS. That's it. They can't go beyond that.
Emily the Strange in the chat room, a frequent listener, I guess. I guess the way to put that, or watcher, I guess, too, says, maybe answered already, but do you know how adopted OpenVPN is with the enterprise? Like, I think OpenStack uses it for their networking.
They do. They do for their network. I mean, it's enterprise. We have a lot of enterprise customers. I mean, just to give you an idea, I mean, on Amazon Cloud itself, we have more than 100,000 access or enterprise instances running as we speak.
Cool. And what's the community process like? Are you working in the public for your community edition with bug tracking and everything all in public? Or do you do snapshots from your private side?
Well, actually, we do have a community, and we do have a community manager, although it's part of the company as well. So a lot of these community people now, they are the engineers, they are part of the company. So it's a balance. We do have once a year a meeting, a hackathon. Last year was this year, actually, in November. It was in Lviv in Ukraine. So once a year, that meeting basically will allow them to basically collaborate and work a plan and so on. So, you know, the community managers coordinate all these activities between the open source and all that. So there is nothing there between, we actually trying to maintain the community as free as possible. It's not like governed or controlled by the company itself, you know. So that's where how the structure of the community is.
Do you get a lot of commits that are not by paid employees of OpenVPN?
We do. But most of them right now are by paid employee. And a lot of these commits also, they come from a few companies as well who are contributing to OpenVPN. For instance, right now we have some contribution from Google. That is more on the obfuscation side because they're interested in that side of the obfuscations. We've got commits from other level of, you know, companies in Europe as well when it comes to security. So we do get from, but most of them are really working for a company. Sophos, we've got also another company that they have one individual who is part of our community as well.
Francis, I didn't get to ask earlier and wanted to. what did the founding of OpenVPN look like as far as the code base itself? What What was the situation that I think you said James was the guy that really started the project itself? What was the situation he was in that he needed this?
Well, actually, he was doing it for hobby because he had a need to basically somehow connect his laptop to a server. And he say, "Oh, okay, I need some level." He didn't like all the other VPN solutions, so he started as a hobby. And then after that, he started floating the idea among among the community in the open source. And he said, "Well, what about if I make it an open source?" So his intention was never to build this as a business at all. That's how it started.
Was he a security researcher or a programmer by trade or just
not
a random
really,
guy?
Not really a random. I mean, he actually initially started as basically he was mostly in the financial kind of things, you know. But he's obviously his background is computer science and programmer. So he learned the security as he was building OpenVPN, and he got very passionate about the cryptography and all that stuff, you know. So he's pretty good at it right now, you know. He's really our expert in that area.
I've seen sometimes there's an interesting overlap between the numbers guys of finance and the numbers guys of cryptography.
Yes, yeah, there is some correlation there probably.
Yes. So you mentioned a new version, a new major version of OpenVPN. Is that coming soon, the open source version of it?
Yes, we're releasing. We actually just released the client version of it on the client side. It's OpenVPN 3, but it's coming under AGPL rather than GPL, AGPL version 3. And so on the server side, we haven't released it there. We did release the commercial version of it. And that was built actually by the company, not by the community. So James and some other developers we have. And so we're going to be releasing that part of it, at least the core, to the community. And I would say in less than a couple of years, you know. But for right now, as we speak, the consumer product we have, the server, at least it's based on actually OpenVPN 3, and the performance, it's just awesome. It's very high performance. And also the enterprise edition of our OpenVPN, the access server, will be next year releasing it with the kernel extension and basically acceleration. So it's going to be performing at the wire speed. So
how did you manage the change of license from GPL to AGPL on the new software? Because I assume there's a bunch of the old code.
Yeah, the OpenVPN 3, it's completely new code. It's completely James started from scratch. He completely started from scratch, believe it or not. So it took him a couple of years, more than 2 years, I would say, almost 3 years, to rewrite the entire thing. And so the whole structure and the model of it, it's completely different than OpenVPN 2. And it's all written in C++. There are some portion of it, it's written in C. OpenVPN 2, it's all written in C. And OpenVPN 3, only the kernel extension and the kernel part of it is written in C, but everything else, it's all C++.
So OpenVPN 3, the client is already open sourced and available. And you said the server portion of that is coming. Do you know the timeline on that?
I can't tell you right now, but I would say at least a year from now, if not within 2 years, definitely we'll be releasing it.
Okay. What is, and I suppose you can answer about OpenVPN 2 or OpenVPN 3, whichever one makes more sense. Do you have like automated testing? Do you have test coverage on the code to make sure that no bugs sneak in?
We do as much as possible, right? We do have the community itself. I mean, we have so many people out there testing OpenVPN, but we do have also right now a quality assurance team that basically, I would say all over here in the U.S., we've got in Ukraine, we've got in Norway, we've got in a number of places. So we do have a pretty good set of people that do the quality assurance. And we have the community as well, you know.
Do you have any idea what, like, percentage of code coverage you've got on automated testing? That's one of those percentages that some of us programmers get really excited about, trying to get as high as possible.
Well, I mean, we try to cover as much as possible, right? But there's always this manual aspects of the QA you have to do. So I would say 50 to 60% is pretty much automated. Still, there's a lot of parts that you have to do manually.
So one of the things that OpenVPN has been known for, at least in my usage of it, is that it runs just about everywhere. There's the Windows client. There's the, you know, you can put it on Mac OS. You can put it on OpenBSD. You could package it on OpenWRT routers. You can get it on Android. You can now get it on iOS. Is it planned for, or does it exist now, the ability to run the version 3 on all of those different platforms?
The OpenVPN, the commercial, or not the commercial, the OpenVPN Connect, which is really our version of OpenVPN, it does run on OpenVPN 3 across all platforms, from Android to iOS, Windows, and Mac. Although on the Windows and Mac, that's pretty much limited to, I would say it's limited to the Enterprise Edition. But on actually iOS and Android, it can run with the community as well. Because we have other community version of OpenVPN for Windows and the Mac, like you mentioned about Tunnelbook and so on, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, as you're saying, I mean, OpenVPN is pretty much very ubiquitous. So it's right now it's on every router, from Linksys to Netgear to all the sort of routers. But most of them actually do support OpenVPN 2. But remember, OpenVPN 2, it's backward compatible with OpenVPN 3. So there is no problem there. The only thing with OpenVPN 3, you get a better performance.
Oh, so interesting. The wire protocol itself hasn't particularly changed between the two between the rewrites.
No, no. The protocol is exactly the same. It's compatible.
Okay, that is excellent to know. And then what do you see next for OpenVPN? I mean, you've got this new shiny version 3. What's coming? What can you tantalize us with for the future?
Well, I mean, we're going with OpenVPN 3, but also we're moving into a little bit. I have to be a little bit careful about this, but we're moving a little bit into a different space. Now, the question whether that's going to be in the open source or not, that's something we have to determine. So we're going, as you know, VPN is pretty much limited for remote access. You're creating a tunnel in order to access from one point to another point, whether it's side to side, from your device to the network. But I think what we're doing right now, we're moving the functionality to the next level. So we're going to be providing more of kind of SDN kind of capability, software defined network. That's mean you would be able with the OpenVPN 3 or whatever product we're going to be launching, you're going to be able to build your network in such a way that you can mesh things and building your own true virtual private network as total without having to deploy your own routers. So that is really the space I would say we're very excited about it. That so OpenVPN is moving from just VPN into more as well evolving to SDN. So that's really our kind of next generation. Whether that's going to be a cloud-based solutions, I mean, that's one obviously ideas we have, and it's going to be also self-hosted kind of capability. So think of it as an enterprise edition. You would be able to build your entire network without having to really deploy virtual routers or any of that. So your SDN becomes pretty much very more flexible than the current SDN right now, the software-defined network, which is only at the management level. And then from the management, you're interconnecting with the managing bunch of hardware. In this case, what we're saying, you can there are two levels here in the software, what we call data plane and control plane and the management plane, right? Control plane. So the data plane typically in the SDN model runs on the hardware itself. So you've got like Cisco routers and things like that you deploy, and then you've got the control plane running in the software. So that's what software-defined network. So you can manage the infrastructure with the software. What we're doing here in the next level and next what's coming, it's basically saying, well, we can do the data plane as well in the software. So now you can distribute and build your network on the fly. All you need actually is just basically a Linux system. So you can lease a server, whatever it is. If you decide to have a server in Switzerland, or you want to have a server in Stockholm, or you want to have one in San Francisco, you can interconnect them all over internet and virtually build your own network and very secure network on top of the internet itself on the fly. So that's really what's coming.
That'll be awesome. And with OpenVPN's reputation, it should definitely be something people should be watching for. I really look forward to that, and I'm glad to have you back on the show again to talk about that once the product comes out.
Go ahead. I was just mentioning. So think of it. You're creating some kind of grid there. So in a more of a virtual grid across the world to really build your network and interconnect. So we're getting into that space.
Awesome. Okay, we're almost out of time. Is there anything we didn't ask that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
No, this is...
So we covered everything you wanted. Okay, cool. Because you're a programmer, two questions I have to ask all the programmers at least, all the coders.
You mean I don't program anymore.
Well, you did at one point, right?
I did, very, very, many years back. But now I'm the CEO, so I'm dealing mostly with architectural and a business and product roadmap and the vision for the company, where we're going and all that. So,
okay, well, when you were back programming, what was your favorite scripting language?
What was my Python?
Okay, I lost that one. And what was your favorite text editor?
I'm sorry?
Text editor. What did you use primarily?
Okay, that was in the old day, probably.
Well, sure. Editors have been around for a long time.
I don't want to reveal that because I end programming. Probably the last program I did was in 19. When was that? The 89.
Wow.
So
a lot of the same editors are still around for that. Yeah. Like Emacs was way back then. So that,
yeah,
Emacs, that was
pretty helpful. That's why I didn't want to mention it. A lot of people say, Emacs, wow, he's a pretty old guy, right?
And people are saying that about me on every show because I always laugh when it's not Emacs. So it's okay, yes. Though. It's great.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, okay, good. I gave you the out.
I don't want to embarrass myself.
No, I still use Emacs every day. In fact,
yeah,
I didn't want to say
I program in assembler and in a program in C language. So, I haven't done
perfectly okay. Hey, well, Francis, it's been wonderful having you on the show to talk about OpenVPN, giving us some of the background history and some of what's on the roadmap. And I look forward to that SDN solution. We've had a couple SDNs on this show before, but sounds like yours is going to be really interesting. So I'm looking forward to that. And thank you for coming on the show and talking about OpenVPN.
Well, thank you. My pleasure. It was good to be with you. Thank you.
Awesome. That was Francis Dina talking about OpenVPN and all things security, actually, as well. What do you think there, Jonathan?
So it's an interesting project. Of course, I mean, it's one that most of us have used. I think that listen to this show, I know the two of us have used it. Sounds like they have some really, really interesting things coming. My only concern, it sounds like they're moving just a little bit away from their their open source roots, and that, that's always a little concerning. To have the version 3 written and waiting a couple of years, and then it sounds like they're starting to question how much they want to go open source in the future. But they've had a really good track record for doing it right so far, and just having the OpenVPN client and server out there as it is now has just been a great tool for so many of us, and such good guys and such good such a neat idea. You asked about IPsec, and the only thing I could think of is I finally had to set up an IPsec tunnel just the other day, and it was horrible. OpenVPN is so much better, and it's really a great project. It's good to have him.
One of the things I saw that as I was researching for this morning show is I didn't realize you could tunnel IPv6 over an IPv4 connection. And I have V6 at my server, and I was thinking about adding a V6 layer to my normal V4 VPN connection, and I'll have V6 on my desktop finally. So that'll be kind of cool. Although, it's really weird. V6 is supposed to be everywhere by now, but so is metric. it's like one of those things. It's like, well, it's lined up with the rest of the world, and And then, of course,
I can get IPv6 on my cell phone, but I've talked to my home ISP here. I cannot get IPv6 here at the office yet. I've talked to my server ISP down in Dallas, and I cannot get IPv6 there either. I'm trying to get it. Nobody will give it to me.
Wow. You know, it's difficult. Comcast did an experiment for a while when I was at my previous location and offered V6 all the way to the door. So I thought that was kind of cool. I'm not sure if I can get it here, though, or I think we're on something else here. I don't know. I don't set it up. I don't care. So let's talk about who's coming up because we're almost out of time here. YattaDB is coming up next week. That was mentioned in last week's show because it's about having really large databases built in. Was it M or Mumps? Well, both. Built in M, so that'll be kind of fun. Immediately following that, really excited for this show because I saw him yesterday. There was Eric Seidel is going to be coming on. He's one of the leads on the Flutter project. And Flutter, of course, is Google's mobile app SDK for crafting high-quality native interfaces on iOS and Android in record time. And so Flutter is amazing. I've been playing with it now for 6 to 7 months now. Actually about a year and a half, somewhere like that. And it just hit 1.0 yesterday. Big announcement. The keynote talks were amazing. They were demonstrating Flutter on desktop, which is a place that it wasn't originally scheduled to go. And also, amazingly, Flutter in a browser. So they're taking the standard Dart to JS code and they're adding a nice layer in front of that. So you'll get these high fidelity, high quality Flutter apps. But the most important thing is that means you can write one code base. It will work on iOS, Android, all three desktops, and in all modern browsers with the same code base. That is game changing. That is really, really amazing. So I am very excited to be in on the ground floor of Flutter, being already talking about it, teaching it. Writing code in it and stuff like that. But now it's just become even better. Oh, I should also mention Fuchsia. I can actually talk about Fuchsia, but I don't know anything about it officially. So I only know what you guys can find out online. So, but that would mean the Internet of Things, which would be great. So like, you know, if you've got a display on your refrigerator, it might be running Fuchsia rather than Android. And then Flutter will be the language of how to build the UIs. So amazing, amazing stuff. So Flutter everywhere. Everybody should look into it. Anyway, Eric's coming on to talk about all that. I've invited a bunch of people from the Flutter chat room to be in our chat room. So we might get overwhelmed with questions because I know they had a lot of questions during the actual keynote. So we will have them on. Just added to the schedule, not to the show. OpenCast. It's a flexible, scalable, and reliable video capture distribution management system for academic institutions. And it's being used by a growing community of developers to collaborate with leading universities and organizations worldwide. So we just added that. That's the first show of the year on January 2nd. There we go. How about that? Following that, Nextcloud. Offering industry-leading on-premises file sync and online collaboration technologies. We also added a show that I can't talk about because it's under embargo right now, but as soon as we get past their embargo, I'll be able to tell you what that guest is, but it's really exciting. And yes, it's blockchain. I'm sorry, but it's good blockchain. I am so sorry. I agreed to this because they came on with a really strong proposition for why they want to be on the show. And then Zen, also scheduled. That's the hypervisor using the microkernel design, providing a lot of virtualization services and some of the biggest ISPs for that, and also on your own on-premises stuff. So that's who we have on the list so far. If you go to twit.tv/floss, you can see other suggestions there. If you have something that's not on that list yet, there we go. Let's use English, Randall. Then have the project leader or community coordinator contact me. That's the way a lot of these shows got on the show. And we have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. And we took a number of questions from the guest list. Not that. Okay, I didn't get enough sleep last night. That's pretty apparent now. A number of questions from the chat room. That's where we get our questions, yes. So do that. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus at least until next summer. I'm not sure what I'm going to do after that. And that tweets over to at Merlin on Twitter. One of the things is I was just recently researching the iTunes reviews for Floss Weekly, and there's nothing in the last 6 years. So if you get your podcast through iTunes, or even if you don't, go over to the Floss Weekly page and give it some love. But give us some new reviews. I mean, a couple of those were pretty painful because it was like, Randall doesn't know what he's doing as a host. And it's like, well, sometimes I do think that. So they let anybody on the show.
But please,
the reviews there help bump it up to the top of the active list and will help other people find Floss Weekly. So please do that. My plugs right now, not much. I'm going to be at KubeCon next week. So I'll be up in Seattle next week and looking for new guests for the show. And I'll still be doing Floss Weekly on Wednesday from there in my hotel room. So I'm crossing my fingers, hoping I get good Wi-Fi in my hotel room. Anything you want to plug there, gentlemen?
I will just mention to keep watching Hackaday.com for my upcoming articles and columns. I've kind of taken a little bit of a hiatus from that because the house needs to get done. And so you were talking about not enough sleep. I did not get enough sleep last night either. I was up till about 2 trying to get drywall done at the house to be able to get it mudded today. So I'm right with you.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Well, normally I'm a little slicker than this, but I must be a little distracted by things going well. I'm really distracted by that. I did a 4-hour marathon watching of this Flutter live event and just amazing stuff. For about the last third of it, my friend from Portland, Wim Leeler, who got me into Flutter actually last year and was actually on stage with me at Scale last year. Was actually sitting there taking questions. I kept trying to ask, hey, say hi to Wim, say hi to me, you know, but he didn't. So it was okay. He was busy. It was like midnight over there in London. So probably pretty crazy stuff. Anyway, that's enough of that. I forgot to mention at the beginning of the show, I'm home. That's the reason you have this nice blank wall behind me and I have my Blue Yeti. So that's always a clue for those that are watching the video, whether I'm home or not, because if I have Yetis here and the wall is blank behind me, then I'm home. But that's good. And you're in your usual place, right, in Oklahoma?
Yes. Yeah, the corporate headquarters, the home office.
Cool. All righty. Well, that's enough rattling, I guess. We'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.